Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson.
All you have to do is follow three simple rules. One, never underestimate your opponent. Expect the unexpected. Two, take it outside. Never start anything inside the bar unless it's absolutely necessary. And three, be nice.
I hope you're listening to Dalton there, Josh. Whatever you've got planned for this Roadhouse review, do not underestimate me. And be nice.
I never underestimate you, Adam. I'll try my best with the other one. This week, a pair of Roadhouse reviews, the 89 original starring Patrick Swayze and the remake with Jake Gyllenhaal. That and more.
Pain don't hurt, Josh, unless you're hurting my feelings.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. You know, this doesn't happen very often, Josh. I'm going to put out a little disclaimer as we're recording this show, as we usually do in our separate homes, have a little work being done on the house, also have two little kids running around. So I can't guarantee that it's going to be a perfectly quiet recording environment. Maybe you'll hear some of those sounds bleeding through. Maybe producer Sam will work his magic and somehow get rid of all of it.
Or maybe it'll just add a barhouse brawl. Aesthetic to the proceedings. This is, we might as well note, a rare daytime recording. And
that's right.
Speaking of Roadhouse, what bad timing, because if I ever could use one of the beers I tend to enjoy when we're recording at night, it's probably this show. Unfortunately, I'm going to stick with my morning tea for this one.
It is pretty early here, Josh. Opening this weekend, I might need some help with the pronunciation here. Godzilla times Kong. What are they doing? Do they say it in the movie?
So I don't believe they say it in the movie. Just saw this last night.
Does Godzilla say it?
No. Godzilla just roars and screams at him. Come on. I'm going to change my strategy here. Previously, I was just going Godzilla Kong. I was just mashing them together. But now that I have seen it, things definitely multiply. I would say Godzilla and Kong are both multiplied. So let's go with Godzilla times Kong, the new empire.
Yeah, you got to include the new empire. I haven't seen it. You have. And not only that, you've been doing your homework. You caught up recently with the entire Godzilla Kong extended universe. And we'll have some thoughts later in the show. Not only have I not seen this movie, but I didn't even know until now that there was a Godzilla Kong extended universe.
I was going to ask you if you knew the name, if you knew what they call this. No.
What is it? Is there?
You probably could have got it on your first guess. Monsterverse.
The GKEU. Oh,
Monsterverse.
I like GKEU better. Let's go with that.
Sure.
Also later in the show, Madness Best of the 1950s. Final four matchups are set. We've got Hitchcock. We've got more Hitchcock. We've got arguably the greatest musical of all time. And Akira Kurosawa's seventh best film.
Oh, you've got the official ranking now.
Well, Sam threw that in, actually. I don't know where I have it ranked, if I'm being totally honest. Just want to play up the bit, Josh. Mm-hmm. For more information or to vote, filmspotting.net/madness. Here we are. Never thought it would happen. Never dreamed back when the show began in 2005 that someday we'd be devoting an opening segment review to Roadhouse. We're giving you a double deuce. We'll get to the unfortunate Jake Gyllenhaal version later. That one is currently streaming exclusively on Prime Video. We are going to begin with the 1989 original, which turns 35 this year, directed by Rowdy Harrington, who is a real person with that real name.
Quick note on Rowdy Harrington, because I don't know if he'll come up much in our discussion, but turns out
he has
made other films.
Oh, yes.
And I've actually seen another one of his films, Bobby Jones, Stroke of Genius, a golf biopic with Jim Caviezel, not great, better than Roadhouse, though, I will say.
Well, let's not get carried away. Roadhouse came to theaters in May 1989 and was the 44th highest grossing movie of the year and made $30 million domestically. Patrick Swayze is Dalton, a cooler who was famous in the nightclub industry for bringing order to bars and other watering holes plagued by violence, or, in Dalton's words, too many 40-year-old adolescents, felons, power drinkers, and trustees of modern chemistry. And here, I thought you might tear down the screenplay, Josh. Dalton, we also learn, has a philosophy degree from NYU and killed a man in Memphis.
I think they call that a double major.
They do. He's hired by the owner of Jasper, Missouri's Double Deuce to work his magic, but he runs into problems when he comes up against the town gangster, Brad Wesley, played by Ben Gazzara.
You know, when I came to this town after Korea, there was nothing. I brought the ball here. I got the 7-Eleven. I got the photomat here. Christ, J.C. Penney is coming here because of me. You ask anybody, they'll tell you.
You've gotten rich off of the people in this town.
You bet your ass I have. And I'm going to get richer. I believe we all have a purpose on this earth, a destiny. I have a faith in that destiny. It tells me to gather unto me what is mine. Oh, Christ, you get paid for beating people up. Tell me you don't love it. Of course you do. You wouldn't be human if you didn't.
This is one of those weeks, Josh, where I couldn't avoid your letterbox takedown of the movie we're talking about. Well, more accurately, I couldn't avoid seeing producer Sam's proposed episode structure in the film Spotting Slack, where he penciled this in for segment one. Why Roadhouse 89 is a trash masterpiece, / JL counterpoint. From there, I saw your letterbox takedown, and it kind of broke my brain. Not because of the sentiment, as unsurprising but still disappointing as it was. Profoundly stupid, beyond what I could ever have imagined, you wrote. That said, I don't begrudge anyone who enjoys nostalgically laughing their way through it. Now, I know you didn't intend to reckon with the notion of nostalgia and were just mocking the movie, but for the past few days, I've been reckoning with the notion of nostalgia, and I've concluded that it's confusing. I get that it's an emotion triggered by a familiar sound or smell or item, and I believe it's real, but can a sudden subconscious wave truly buttress, say, a favorable revisit of a movie you enjoyed as a kid? Maybe I'm overthinking all of this because, in a bit of coincidence spotting, my rewatch of Roadhouse and the release of the remake corresponded with a trip back to my hometown to celebrate the 50th birthday of a guy who has been one of my best friends since third grade. He also happens to be the lead singer in the band I've been part of since 2 years before Roadhouse was released. Did I mention that we're a cover band? And when we reunite, it's not just the music of our youth that we cover all the old band stories and school stories and movie quotes. Forget the free beer we get in exchange for performing. These weekends are fueled by 100% pure, uncut nostalgia. Does that explain why I enjoy playing Talk Dirty to Me for the 2700th time when I haven't otherwise willingly listened to it in multiple decades? The crunch of the first C chord opens up a wormhole that transports five middle-aged friends back to middle school. My musical taste, along with my movie taste, has evolved considerably since the band began. But as dumb as Talk Dirty to Me is, one might go so far as to call it profoundly stupid, it's fun. I wouldn't classify it as particularly good, but it is a good time. Now, this is the part where you assume I will equate Roadhouse to that cheesy Poison tune from my past. Dumb, but fun, a good time that isn't particularly good. Except, not only do I disavow the concept of guilty movie pleasures, I disavow the concept that Roadhouse isn't good. Here's something else that's dumb. Writing a Roadhouse setup prompting you to pontificate about nostalgia when you don't like it now and didn't even see it then. In your effortless adolescent sophistication, you evaded the gravitational pulls of both Bret Michaels' excessively hairsprayed bleach blonde locks and Patrick Swayze's magnificent mullet. But genuinely, I'm curious to hear your musings on the power of nostalgia, especially when the alternative is your articulation of how risible Roadhouse is. However, this is film spotting, not psychology spotting, and I haven't come up with a clever ruse to get you off the podcast premises yet, so maybe you'll offer me a little of both. Do you believe nostalgia is such a commanding force that it can completely shut down one intellectual, artistic shield? Under what circumstances? And since there's no hope of tag-teaming this review like we're Dalton and Wade Garrett, you're older than me, so definitely would be Wade in this scenario.
Thank
also,
you.
I too had a mullet in 89. Indulge me and imagine an alternate universe where a teenage Josh Larson sees Roadhouse and suddenly transforms into the only kid doing Tai Chi at dawn on the lawn of his Southwest suburban Chicago home. Note that in said alternate universe, this infinitely way cooler Josh follows every blissful mind and body cleansing session with a smoke.
Mm. Yeah, wasn't ever really tempted to smoke either, Adam. I don't know what was wrong with me at that age.
You were too good. Too good of a boy.
No, you do. You know, you do like to pull the word sophistication out when we have differing memories of the late 80s. And I don't know that that's accurate. I just think I had a different experience of what pop culture attracted me at the time. If I'm looking at 1989, it
isn't
wasn't
that sophistication.
It wasn't that I was. No, it's a different experience. Sophistication okay. is like I'm watching art films, you know, at that moment. And maybe
it's all relative.
I was a freshman in high school, I think. So maybe I was starting to dip my toes in that arena. But when I look at 89, man, the thing I was most geeked about was Tim Burton's Batman. So maybe it's just a matter of me being nerdier than you were at that time. And those were the distinctions in tastes and why something...
I was in a rock band.
Yeah, so clearly you were cool with a capital K.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So yeah, it might just be a distinction of the things we were interested in the time at the time. I have a little regret about the Letterboxd review, I'll say. Profoundly stupid. I would not want any form of the word profound near Roadhouse 1989. I should have left that entirely out. But your question is taking me directly where I want to go, at least, in hearing about your experience from the film. Because the alternate universe scenario, there's not much we can do with that. You know, this wasn't a movie that attracted me then. And probably those are some of the reasons I still didn't enjoy it now. But I think I was trying to bring a different lens to it this time. I honestly thought I was going to get a cheesy 80s action comedy that, sure, wasn't great, but had some endearing qualities. And unfortunately, I didn't find that. But the nostalgia question is a terribly difficult one. Mm-hmm. And
that's why I'm confused.
I don't think that's the right answer. I will say this. I think nostalgia is a completely legit lens through which to view movies and appreciate them. This is a powerful emotional way of engaging with art. And I was thinking about this too. I think it's maybe even more so the case with music, because music is going to instantly transport you to a friend's backyard or a ride on a bike or being in the car with friends and listening to a song for the first time. And it does not matter if now, when you are perhaps more sophisticated and know more about music, you could say, this is just a hack song. It doesn't matter because it's triggering all those feelings. And those are valid feelings. Those are valid memories. They are often, to your stories, tied directly to the people you originally shared the art with. And there is no need to dismiss that when revisiting this form, whether it's music or movies. I engage in it too, just probably with different films. I do think when you're talking about arts criticism, which is ostensibly what we're doing on the show, the way I would say it is I don't think nostalgia should be dismissed. I don't think it can be the guiding force. And I don't think you're arguing this either, but just generally, as we think about the topic. So I don't think we need to completely toss nostalgia aside, but we maybe need to adjust the calibrations a little bit. I'm fine with nostalgia being part of the mix. We're not robots. But I do think you have to bring something to the table if you're doing arts criticism that you appreciate about a movie that's separate from your nostalgic feelings about it. And here's where, you know, you're joking about the, what was that a Poison song you were talking about, you said?
Yes.
You're joking about the, you know, the crunch of the first C chord, but that's something specific and aesthetic that you can say, hey, maybe most people consider this song to be trash and it's not taken very seriously, but here's a particular thing that I appreciate about the construction of the song, the way it works. These are the things that I think we can bring to bear, two pieces of nostalgia, art that that brings about nostalgia and say, okay, yeah, I love it because of those memories, but I also think it holds up because of this. So that's the sort of stuff I want to get into. Now, it's tough when this doesn't work out. I think of movies like Goonies for me. I think of movies like Ghostbusters. I would have died for those films when they first came out, right? And they're both movies I still enjoy when I watch now. But they've really fallen in my esteem, at least as an adult. And I recognize that. Back to the calibrations, the nostalgia is doing a lot of work. And maybe there's a few things here or there that I can say, yeah, but this was really smart about the film. This is something that, you know, the movie makes me think about now that it didn't then. This is something I realize the movie is thinking about now that I missed then. Or again, just some of these creative choices that you appreciate. Doesn't always work out. Goonies, Ghostbusters, sometime it does. Sometimes you get Back to the Future and it's like, whoa, this hits all the nostalgic notes, but as an adult, it offers even more. It was great then. It's greater now. So that's what I want to hear, Adam. Why is Roadhouse 89, if it is, your Back to the Future? Or is this just more of a nostalgic experience that, you know, I just can't have not having seen it before?
Yeah, you put it back on me, and it's a tough thing to address. I mean, I do need to say, first of all, that Back to the Future is my Back to the Future. It's not Roadhouse. I've got all of those as well. And that movie that you just mentioned, the Michael J. Fox movie, is one of those landmark nostalgic films for me. I do need to circle back real quick and say that you definitely don't deserve to be Wade Garrett in this scenario. No way you should get to be Sam Elliott, especially when you're clearly Brad Wesley. For the purposes of this review, but your answer about nostalgia was great. And that is the tough part of it. When I said I'm confused or I'm confounded by it, the thing that I've been really wrestling with is, you mentioned it can be a guiding force, but how is it calibrated? Well, how is it calibrated? How do you calibrate it when, I think, going back to even what you said about hearing the sound of a certain chord or hearing a song that reminds you of the past, it's a subconscious reaction. Mm-hmm. So how do I know, no matter how intellectually rigorous I think I'm being or how studiously I'm taking notes and paying attention to things, that this is very much the me of now responding to, how can I know if I'm completely separating it? That said, I'm not looking for excuses, Josh, to justify my reaction to this film. And I hope we can have a conversation about it where we understand that in praising it, or even as I'm going to do here in a moment, talk about some of the aesthetic choices the movie makes, I'm not suggesting that Rowdy Harrington or most of the people involved with this film are making films on the level of Martin Scorsese or, you know, Antonioni.
Sure,
of course. That's not what the film is aspiring to be. I do think, and this was a surprise for me, having not seen it since probably 89 or, you know, a couple of years after on TV, the first 30 minutes or so of this film, the setup, I think are electric. And I think it's world building the way really good films do. World building through character and world building through the use of the camera. I looked this up afterwards because I was startled enough by it. I'm watching how the camera is moving. I'm watching the attention to detail of the camera. And you see it's shot by Dean Cundey, who shot all this Carpenter stuff like Halloween and Escape from New York and Big Trouble in Little China. Guess what else he shot? Oh, The Thing. He also shot Romancing the Stone and Back to the Future, as well as Jurassic Park and Apollo 13. You get a sense right away from that opening series, the opening sequence of Kevin Teig's character, the Double Deuce bar owner, going to find Dalton and him then making the decision to come down to Missouri. You see that they really understand, the filmmaker here, Harrington and Cundey, understand how to use the camera to tell a story. There's very little dialogue. Again, it's all about what the camera is noticing. It being Roadhouse and it being 1989, sometimes what the camera's noticing, Josh, is the attractive women who are going by. A lot of male gaziness going on.
Yeah, right? It starts a little like a Fast and Furious road race. Yeah. That's the camera angle you get quite a bit.
Exactly. But point of view shots, and again, the movement itself to capture a mood and convey information, and particularly character information. You start to understand what the environment of these clubs is like, how business is transacted, what this character is aspiring to. And all he's aspiring to is to open a club that will make him a little bit of money and will give people a good time. But watching him, the camera watching him react and take in information, we then process who he is as a character. Now, that's not notable because, well, then I really care about that guy. I had to look up his name later, right? He doesn't actually have a significant role in the film. And on my list of favorite Roadhouse characters, he's probably, you know, at number 11 or 12. But I knew who he was. I know what he wants. It sets up the entire action of the film and grounds it in a realistic way. And it, the movie doesn't take any of that for granted the way you might expect this movie to do, based on its reputation anyway, that it's just going to sort of revel in the vulgarity of its subject matter. No, there's actual craft here and people paying attention to what they're doing with the camera and the storytelling structure. And if I'm going to reject the idea, and I am, of nostalgically laughing at Roadhouse, though there are parts that are undeniably a hoot, I think the movie, to its credit, plays it as it should. It plays it completely straight. I was thinking, Josh,
well, this is a big question we have to get to. So yeah, let me just happy to pause there and
get into
and
it.
Just talk about a little bit. This is the good stuff that I wanted to hear about. You know, in terms of the camera work and stuff, it's not inept. It's like a very serviceable Copacabana, bring us into the nightclub imitation, even though this is obviously before Goodfellas. But it's that, you know, the camera's going to walk through a nightclub. I think that Dean Cundey was one of the first names I noticed and made me sit up, especially when the first image, I believe the very first image we get, is of a great fluorescent sign. Mm-hmm. And where the camera is moving down, it's taking up the entire screen pretty much. And I thought, oh, okay, he's involved. Look at this shot. Okay, here we go. I have to say that was probably the most engrossing shot in the movie.
Yeah.
And even when we get into that, you know, the first club part of this, and, you know, you don't want to hold a budget against the film, but this is, you know, actually the first club is almost a better setting, more stronger production design than the Double Deuce. The Double mm-hmm. Deuce is just so clearly like some chintzy soundstage with whatever furniture they could drag in. And obviously, because half of it's going to get broken before the scene ends. I guess my main problem was, when you talk about world building and you talk about character, it was so ridiculous. And here's where we can probably get into the question you were about to touch on. Mm-hmm. It was so ridiculous. This world, and this is fine if you want to do this, but would not exist anywhere outside of a cheesy 80s Hollywood movie. These people,
yes,
these places, these characters, their predicaments. And so when it is that ridiculous, I don't, you know, even if the camera work was beyond functional and even brilliant, it's not going to get me to care or invest in these things or even this world. I just could not take it seriously. Now here's the bigger question, which is kind of, you know, complicated like the nostalgia one is, which you were getting to, is how much does that matter? How much does Roadhouse 89 know that a lot of this is silly? And is that a legitimate measuring stick for the movie, or shouldn't it matter? Like, do we place more value on a movie that's kind of goofy and knows it? Or do we actually enjoy a movie that's goofy and doesn't know it? It's almost like I was thinking about it in these terms. Is it a laughing at or laughing with question? Mm-hmm. I don't know that I have a preference either way. I just know watching Roadhouse, it didn't seem to have a firm grasp of what it wanted to be in terms of that question. And maybe that's why it left me a little wanting as well. Is there were times where you could tell, you know, they were purposely being jokey. There were times where they wanted to be earnest. Some actors were doing one, others were doing another. And so I couldn't even get my hands on what Roadhouse was before I could then ask myself the question, was it meeting that standard, if it should be a standard at all?
Yeah, I disagree with the notion that the movie doesn't know exactly what it is and that everybody is singing off the same.
Everybody.
That's everybody. That's my sense of the film. And again, goes back to,
and what do they think
professionalism on display. I'll get to that. And I'll frame it in terms of, because I was wrestling with this myself. I mean, here's what I'll say. Not that you necessarily go into movies wanting it always to be like this, but I think what the tension is here, Josh, is that we're acknowledging that there's a lot of absurdity when it comes to this film. So you want the film to be smart enough to be aware and laugh at itself. And I'm glad the movie doesn't laugh at itself. And I don't want to watch a movie, frankly, that laughs at itself. I don't think that
there's
any benefit
to that. You don't want this to be like a Sharknado or like a Velocipastor.
No, and I don't think the movie is. And so, and let me say something too, because I know I'll at least touch on this a little bit more. What you're describing in terms of this being kind of, here again, an alternate universe, like nothing real about it, that's not any different than the movies that this film is clearly lifting from, a Western. Westerns are transporting you when you go to the film to watch this heightened world of heroes and villains.
Yeah, but they're not silly. They're not silly.
I don't know if I totally agree with that. They do play it straighter. That's part of the, what I would say is the charm of this film, is that what it knows it is a late 80s version of those films. And I think it's at least aware that it's playing with the idea, not in a challenging or subversive way. It's not a neo-Western. I wouldn't call it that. But it's playing with the idea of how far can we stretch this? This idea of taking a Pale Rider type character, a High Plains Drifter, Shane, even elements of Rio Bravo here, and transport it to being a bouncer in a Midwestern club. I think that's what the movie very much knows that it is. And so I was thinking about films that do and don't hold up from the time, and movies from the time that I liked then, like I liked Roadhouse, but weren't quite as memorable, and also now looking back on them, certainly to me, aren't quite as good. And I know you like to occasionally come up with ratios here. Didn't you have an Alex Garland, as we're talking about Ex Machina next week? You put forth some ratio about the level of confusion you have about what it's all about or whatever. So here's where I'm going to go with this. The movie I thought of as the perfect kind of compare-contrast to this film, and I do think it's a perfect compare-contrast because I think a lot of people would say it's no different. The movie that I had in mind was probably another movie, Josh, in 1987 that you didn't see, though maybe you were a bigger Sly Stallone fan. Did you see Over the Top in 87?
No, this was not my wheelhouse.
Okay, so this is the arm wrestling movie. He's an arm wrestler, and he drives a truck. He's got a great name. His name's Lincoln Hawk. And that's a movie I would nostalgically and do nostalgically laugh at. Here's Sam, I hope, as our producer, is going to do right by all of us and let us know exactly what happens when Lincoln Hawk takes his hat and turns it around.
What I do is I just try to take my hat and I turn it around, and it's like a switch that goes on. And when the switch goes on, I feel like another person. I feel like a truck, like a machine. I own.
It's something about, here's that ratio. It's something about its volume and its ratio. And I'm going to workshop this some more. I'm going to get it trademarked. It's its ratio and volume of absurdity and earnestness to ambition. Over the Top is thoroughly inane, yet stone cold serious. And Stallone is clearly convinced, if you watch any frame of it, he's clearly convinced he's making something that will change the audience's lives. He knows that the world beats nobody halfway, which you would get if you'd ever seen the movie, Josh. Roadhouse is silly, yet plays it straight. And I think all the people involved know exactly what type of genre pleaser they're making. It aspires to be nothing more. This is the ambition part. It aspires to be nothing more and nothing less than a little bit of a goofy experiment in translating that arc of the Western lone gunman to being a bouncer. I think it wants to provide its audience the same thing that character, his name's Frank Tilghman, that Kevin Teig plays, that he wants to provide the patrons of the new Double Deuce, an enjoyable night out. Justify going out to the theater in 1989, getting a babysitter to see something you otherwise wouldn't see in your everyday life or on the big screen. That's its level of ambition. And with that level of ambition, the ratio of silliness or absurdity, which is definitely here, don't get me wrong, and its earnestness, how straight it plays it, how relatively serious it takes it, somehow the balance is right here, where with so many other 80s movies like Over the Top, the balance isn't there.
So it's the perfect cocktail of these ingredients for you.
I think so.
And what's interesting, and I as I said, I can't speak to Over the Top, so that's not as helpful to me in trying to understand it, but it's interesting, you know, when I rated it on Letterboxd, I would get people commenting saying, you don't understand. This is glorious because it knows, you know, every instance that it's ridiculous. Not exactly the argument you're making. I think you're talking about a blend. Yeah. You're talking about a blend.
But I would have people saying, "I don't think it's winking at us." Yeah, and thank God it isn't.
I have people saying like it's so great because it's doing that and it has this ultra meta self-awareness. It's a perfect example of that. Then like two comments later would be, it is glorious because it has no idea how bad it is. And so I bring that up just to say, like, clearly there are mixed messages being sent if different people are receiving it in different ways.
Just some less astute viewers, Josh. Well, that's
okay.
All.
I mean,
there
could
be that
you can
too.
Personally attack those commenters, but these are people who are receiving the movie.
Disagree.
In completely opposing ways. And I guess that's was my experience as well. It was not this perfect cocktail. I saw all those elements you're talking about, but maybe it's more helpful to talk in particulars about this. And you discussed Stallone's performance. So let's go to Swayze. Let's have the Swayze conversation here. I am not all that familiar with Swayze. I've seen Ghost. I've seen Point Break. Think he's really good in Point Break. Don't have a lot of memory of what he was like in Ghost, and a handful of other things, but I am by no means a completist. And so I went into this thinking, maybe this will unlock Swayze for me, right? Like, help me, because clearly Roadhouse, as we've established, was not an immediate hit, despite his relative, you know, notoriety or stardom at the time. It did take a while for people to latch onto whatever it's doing, whatever you think it's doing. That's kind of why it's become this cult film to a degree. But Swayze, you know, was a real thing. And I thought, maybe yes, I'll find was. Something here that if it didn't hit me initially, I can recognize, okay, this is what he's got. Man, was I was so mystified coming out of this, and it speaks to the awareness thing. If he's one of the people I would posit seems to be playing the movie like you're describing Stallone, mm-hmm. playing over the top. Mm. He is completely serious about this. And let me talk about how. First of all, let me just talk about the performance. You know, he's sort of this Zen bouncer. He's got these rules. And, you know, never mind. One thing that was amusing to me, and we can debate how intentional this was, like, as soon as he states his rules, the next scene is him breaking them. It's like they never come back into play, really. But anyways, I like that he's this Zen bouncer, and I'm thinking, okay, this completely wooden, unemotive, flat performance. You talked about how there's no dialogue. I started to wonder, like, did they take dialogue away from him because it would be dangerous in his hands? And then I said, okay, maybe it's because he's this Zen bouncer and he's supposed to be this wooden figure is part of his character, which we should appreciate. His pulse doesn't quicken in this movie, Adam, until he gets Sam Elliott on the phone, which is another dynamic we can maybe talk about. He's just so boring. And yet we're supposed to take him very seriously. Maybe the screenwriters put in things like studying philosophy at NYU as a joke. But when Swayze delivers the line about, you know, what he was doing there to Kelly Lynch's doctor is like, man, search for faith. Okay, I guess he's having fun there. I don't know. The dumb backstory of him ripping a guy's throat out. Like, maybe it goes back to your algorithm thing. So I tried to give him the benefit of the doubt. And then the Zen defense of his bad acting falls apart when he starts to show emotion and he gets really angry. It is brutally false in every possible way. And so going back to comparisons, like, is he doing a Val Kilmer in Top Secret thing here? I don't think so. I think he's doing more of like a Stallone in other Stallone movies, fully committing to the seriousness of this character. Those Tai Chi scenes, you know, that made me feel he's most invested in those. And here's what I will give Swayze, okay? This might just be purely a physicality thing that I'm not tapping into, that he has this physical
physicality
presence.
Is the word.
Yeah, and I can see that, you know? Goes back to the fact that he's shirtless throughout this. There is something very interestingly cat-like and dance-like about him in the sex scene with Kelly Lynch, where that's kind of where I sat up and thought, okay, This is unique. This is unlike other actors. This is bringing an energy to this scene that is interesting. It's also, I might add, 1,000% serious. It's not like knowing we're sending up anything or I'm in a Western or it's like this is going to be the sexiest scene that has ever been on screen. Yeah, but that's not
what
you're arguing.
Which is why it works.
No.
Yes, I am arguing that. It's playing.
No, Adam, the ratio in that scene.
There's no sending up of this film at all. That's the reason it works.
It's not self-aware. The ratio is not even there.
It knows it's the entertainment it is. That's being self-aware. It's just not laughing at itself. There's a difference, Josh.
Not in Swayze's performance. Not in Swayze's performance.
I think Swayze's performance is a...
There's an off-kilter element to the ratio, at least for me. I think Kelly Lynch in that scene... It's a great scene to look at how this movie is not cohesive. Kelly Lynch is one of the few on-screen performers who I feel knows what's really going on. I think Ben Gazzara does as well. And Kelly Lynch in that scene actually laughs because she's getting thrown up against a chimney made of boulders that Swayze is so committed to his own physicality, which is interesting, that he doesn't recognize. And all she can do is laugh that this is happening in this movie, completely out of the moment, completely out of character. She and Ben Gazzara know what's going on. I mean, here's the difference. They both have a twinkle in their eye that is not a wink. It's not a wink.
Okay.
I think that's what you're talking about. I think they're the exception to a lot of what is going on in this movie.
Well, Mr. Dalton, you may add 9 staples to your dossier of 31 broken bones, 2 bullet wounds, 9 puncture wounds, and 4 stainless steel screws. That's an estimate, of course. I'll give you a local.
No, thank you.
Do you enjoy pain?
Pain don't hurt.
Most of my patients would disagree with you. Okay.
You say this performance as Dalton is so boring. We haven't jumped ahead to Jake Gyllenhaal's performance. He may be a much better actor than Swayze in the grand scheme of things, and certainly when it comes to technical aspects of a performance, but my goodness, boring is not the word I would use to describe any moment of Patrick Swayze as Dalton here. I will point out, I'm going to defend the performance. I think it's a good performance. I think it's a perfectly appropriate performance in tone, size, scale, whatever you want to say for this film. But maybe you can't fully appreciate it without remembering what it felt like. This is where nostalgia may come in a little bit. Without remembering what it felt like to watch Swayze in the 80s and to see that physicality from the Dirty Dancing character. He brings that same sort of movement and fluidity now to this character. It felt like exactly what we wanted from our star at the time, including seeing him shirtless and seeing him be a philosophical badass. Even in Dirty Dancing, he's got a little bit of that element to him. He gets helped out a lot.
But wait, when you say philosophical badass, are we supposed to take his philosophy seriously or not?
Well, it depends what you mean by philosophy. Are you talking about his rules or the way he approaches life generally, Josh? Two different things.
I mean, that his rules are supposedly the way he approaches
his life.
Here's what I mean.
He's thoughtful. He's thoughtful. He's idealistic. He wants to fight for the little man. Mm. He respects the men that he meets around him. So he has a point of view on the world, and that's something. I don't think you can watch the film and suggest that's not the case. Now, he's helped out a lot by Harrington, and that Harrington does apply in Cundey a lot of tricks here that, you know, go back to the Westerns and the classic Hollywood cinema days, which is everybody talks about him and says his name before we even get to meet him. And then the reputation builds and builds and builds, and we don't actually see him do anything. We don't see any of the badass come out until I wrote it down, the 27-minute mark. After the 27-minute mark, the movie delays that gratification until that point. It's building up, again, just like a lot of these other characters from the past, builds up this mystery. And so then what has to pay off is, does it deliver? When the hero has to finally pull out the gun and do his job, does it deliver? And Swayze delivers in every scene for me. And there's a difference going back to what you were saying about Stallone. There's a difference between deadly serious and playing it straight. And he's playing it straight, but I do think, this is not winking, Swayze at least brings to that character a humanity. He has a sense of humor. He can laugh at himself. There's many cases in the movie where he does. He's vulnerable. The things you're saying in terms of like the pulse doesn't quicken, I actually see his pulse quicken a lot. And that's one of the interesting ways it goes against the films it is a reference to or an homage to, that very stoic, emotionless,
I get the archetype.
Cowboy character.
I get the archetype.
But he's
just not
the archetype.
It off.
But he's not it. That's what's great about the performance, Josh, is that his pulse seems to quicken all the time. He becomes a little unhinged. He gets emotionally caught up in these scenarios way quicker than any of those heroes from those other films. He isn't the great hero who just gets to walk that line and be himself. He's constantly getting caught up. And his scenes with Kelly Lynch work because he shows that sense of humor and he shows that vulnerability. There are times where you see
they're in two different movies.
How upset he is. And upset is never a word you would use to describe any of those heroes, those archetype characters from the past. That's, again, for me, how the movie knows exactly what it's doing. And Swayze's the perfect character for that. Perfect actor.
The twinkle is never in his eye. That is what you're describing. And I will say about the physicality, you know, I'm sure you're right, because I do remember Swayze being a thing. And I wish there had been more evidence of that in this movie beyond their one sex scene. You get it, you know, in terms of a visual when he's doing Tai Chi, or I don't know if it is Tai Chi, but whatever he's doing, you get it as a visual. So there's some of it there, but like the fight scenes here are so
fun,
badly choreographed. You don't get any sense of Swayze's physicality in those because of how they're staged. I would imagine there are better showcases, and I'd have to go back, see some of his other stuff, revisit some of the ones I've seen that speak to the physicality, because it's absolutely there. I'm not denying it's not there. It's the one thing I kind of latched onto and was like, yes, okay. And just, you know, would have expected there to be more of it in Roadhouse. Speaking of nostalgia, can I just ask you, well, let me say one nice thing about Roadhouse. Jeff Healey Band. Absolutely the artistic high point. I mean, this is like,
I might agree. It's that good.
So good. So good. And I think he's good too. Whenever he's asked to kind of like, you know, move the plot along a little bit with some background information and that sort of stuff.
It's the world building, Josh, giving us actual characters.
No, Adam, I'm trying
it's
to say something
characters.
Nice. Don't push it.
we know who every single one of those supporting players are in this film.
Is the world building also that Ben Gazzara's crime boss, his complex is across the golf pond from Dalton's barn. I just love how they can kind of just sit on their back porches and look
you
at
clearly
each other.
Never been to Missouri.
I don't think anyone involved with this movie, including the sets, have ever been to Missouri. Are there like mountains this big in Missouri? I'm trying to, you know, in the background when he's driving around and you can see, it's been a long time since I've been in Missouri. Maybe there are mountains back there, but it seemed a little curious to me. The nostalgia question I want to ask you, I wasn't that much aware of Roadhouse. I was very aware of the insult chicken dick. Now,
I've never heard it in my life until this movie.
So is this where it came from?
Is it? I actually don't remember it being said, so it didn't stick out to me the way it did.
You don't remember when you... Well, no, it was like that. Like, as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh, I remember that getting tossed around in the parking lot at school. Like, I found ground zero for chicken dick. Okay, well...
Didn't expect this review to go there. I have two more pages of notes on Roadhouse, but the good thing, Josh, is that we're not done talking about... Well, I say it's a good thing because even though we're going to get to the new one here in a bit, I know there's no way to talk about that, at least for me, without making some more references to this film. So there's still plenty more Road Talk 89 and 24 ahead. Roadhouse is streaming on Prime Video. It's available VOD. Maybe it's still playing on basic cable in an actual Roadhouse. Go to Missouri, look for it. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
We will get to Roadhouse 24 in a bit, but first, a couple of very easy ways you can help the show. Whether you're a longtime listener or just finding us, would you take a minute and give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify? Do it right now while you're listening. It is very easy, and every new rating or review will help an independently produced show like ours reach new listeners. We wanted to give a thank you to Olive Juice 456. That's That's the best brand of olive juice, Adam. Over on Apple Podcasts, we got this very kind review. In a time when most of us are struggling to argue about things in politically fraught situations, what an enormous service Josh and Adam provide by modeling respectful, good-humored, and spirited arguments about the stories that animate our culture.
Stories like Roadhouse.
I don't know if we should read
it. I think we pulled it off.
Did we? Okay, good, good.
We're all still smiling and laughing.
This show has become an indispensable companion for Saturday chores, but these conversations aren't a chore. They're a labor of movie love. Well, thank you, Olive Juice.
Another way to support us, join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. We would like to welcome new family member, Andrew Corsini from Birmingham or Birmingham. It's UK, not Alabama. We can't say Roll Tide. Well, actually, we can say Roll Tide because it's just fun to say. We have had the pleasure of meeting Andrew a couple of times, came to a show here in Chicago all the way from Birmingham. He came to our LA show, and he is now a family member officially. His favorite review or top five here on the show, he says the funniest episode is the Raiders of the Lost Ark, Sacred Cow with Michael Phillips. The Letterboxd top four for Andrew is Fitzcarraldo, Barry Lyndon, Akira, and Metropolis.
Intriguing.
Eclectic mix there. Favorite movie he revisited recently. You'll love this. Totally agree with Josh, The Blair Witch Project. This is one of the best films ever made.
There
Not
you
just
go,
horror
Andrew.
Horror films ever made, Andrew says.
Wow, I love it.
A random film or filmmaker he loves. And this is great because I like this filmmaker and I didn't know this movie was a thing. He says, I have a soft spot for William Friedkin's The Guardian. And thankfully, he clarified which movie that is. It's the Killer Tree movie.
How have I not known this? And will I be watching this tomorrow?
And here is an inspired choice for a movie he credits with being a cinephile. It's not just Jaws. It's the DVD commentary for Jaws.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Having done Jaws at Ebert Interruptus a couple years ago, just, you know, breaking down every aspect of that production, I could see listening to a DVD commentary really sucking you into studying film at that level.
Our thanks to Andrew and our official welcome to the family. Of course, in addition to keeping us doing what we're doing, your support comes with perks. You get to listen early and ad free. You get the weekly newsletter. You get monthly bonus shows. You get complete archive access. FilmSpottingFamily.com.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
A friend of mine suggested I come talk to you. I own a roadhouse out in the Florida Keys. Lately, it's been attracting the wrong clientele. I can pay you good money. Judging by your car, you need this.
Well, I like my car.
Think about it. Come on,
bro. That was Jake Gyllenhaal and Jessica Williams in the trailer for Roadhouse, the 2024 version. The action this time gets transplanted from mid-America Jasper, Missouri to the sunny Florida Keys. I think Adam proposed title for this movie, having seen it now, Florida Men. We should just go with that. I think Florida Men kind of covers it. It was directed by Doug Liman, who also made The Bourne Identity, Edge of Tomorrow, and Swingers. The story pretty much stays the same. Gyllenhaal's Dalton isn't necessarily a famed cooler, but rather a disgraced UFC fighter with a past that is just a YouTube video away from getting exposed. He does take a gig as a bouncer at they try to get a lot of mileage out of this joke. I kind of missed it the first time. Apparently this place is called The Roadhouse. That's the joke, I think. Right, Adam?
Okay. It's something.
Okay. Well, anyway, that's where he ends up working. And he runs into trouble with a local heavy, or actually the son of a heavy played by Billy Magnuson, who wants the land that the club is on. So, Adam, we know by now very much about your love for 89's Roadhouse. I think you were looking forward to this, or at least had some hopes. It was Gyllenhaal, actor you really admire, a director, Liman, who has done a lot of good stuff. I'm not even going to ask if you liked it. I'm going to ask, how did this fall short? And actually, if I could be more specific, can I ask you to apply your ratio? And this is the trouble I had. Like, what was off in the chemistry here in terms of that knowingness and awareness? Because I don't think you can deny at all that this movie is aware. Is that the crux of the problem? It's too aware? Was it too aware for you?
I think the ratio is off, and I'm going to build up to that, Josh. For me, I got to start out. I got to come into the bar big, right? I saw this movie actually before I rewatched Roadhouse 89. Of course, I'd already seen Roadhouse 89 many times, so I wanted to start with the new one. I'm wondering what my reaction would have been to it had I watched and enjoyed as much as I did Roadhouse 89 and then took this on, if I actually would have hated it even more. I think it's among the worst, if not the worst movie I've watched for this show. And before anyone freaks out, like I'm trying to be exceptionally harsh or going crazy, we've been doing this show a long time. We've discussed a lot of movies, but we do talk about one to two movies a week, and they're the movies we want to talk about, not what's new. So I'm not here to proclaim Roadhouse 24 to be the worst movie that's been released since 2005. I'm just saying, when I think back on movies I've given one star ratings to out of five, I think there's only one or two maybe prior to this. So for me,
I'm going to need, not, I think not it's today, that bad. But I'm going to need that list at some point, please.
Yeah, I'll have to hunt it down. I'll check in with the film spotting historian and not to meander too much here, Josh, but is it now time for the congressional inquiry? I know there's a lot going on in our world, but the congressional inquiry into Rotten Tomatoes, because I looked it up this morning and Roadhouse 24, as of right now, is fresh at 61%. I don't know if my review is going to make a dent, but I am flummoxed. I'm flummoxed by that. I would never use a cliche, never use a cliche, like this movie makes the original Roadhouse look like Citizen Kane, but Doug Liman makes Rowdy Harrington look like Orson Welles. How's that? It's that.
I mean,
off.
You were essentially making that case earlier. So
it I think in every way.
Is it that camera?
I prefer the
GoPro VR headset camera. Oh, you just couldn't abide it.
That's the only thing this movie is striving to do, is do something groundbreaking, I suppose, with these fight scenes.
Yeah,
I think they're a mess and completely uninteresting.
It's pretty disastrous.
And maybe that has something to do with it being streaming and not seeing it in the theater and different rates on the screen. I don't know, but it doesn't work.
No.
And all of the other fundamental building blocks of storytelling that, unlike you, I think are keenly on display in the first film are just completely thrown out the window here. And it really doesn't make sense, because I haven't seen any other Rowdy Harrington movies. He has made seven or eight other feature films. None of them. I know he made Striking Distance. Again, haven't seen them, but they aren't notable. They're not films we've devoted any time to right here on the show. There are lots of good Doug Liman movies. I love The Bourne Identity, Edge of Tomorrow, Go, Swingers. I like American Made, even the Tom Cruise film. We talked about that. Didn't love it, but I liked it. All this attention went into the fancy camera tricks during those fight scenes. Zero attention paid to story, plot, characters, developing a lead character, developing a villain. As dumb as the original might be, there is a logic to it. The movie establishes, as I said, its own world, its own rules, and it establishes it through character building. That is completely gone here. And so I think it does amp up the level of winking. Certainly you see that in terms of the inclusion of Conor McGregor in this film, where what is a cartoon then just literally becomes a cartoon. So that ratio of the twinkle or the winking, which I think is annoying, it's amped up here. It doesn't have the ambition to even just tell a straight ahead story. And it infuses those stupid references, the meta references to the Western, whereas the first Roadhouse just was it and gave us little touches, like the characters all having names from Westerns like Garrett and Doc, Dalton, etc. This movie actually, it's sort of like the, you know, I have nothing to write assignment, so I'm going to write about having writer's block. That's what I felt like I was watching with this movie every time it brought up the Western. And even then it's like someone decided we need to add a line later to say, oh, we're not making a Western anymore. It's now a mystery thriller. They needed a character to say it because they decided halfway through to take the movie in a completely different direction. There is nothing consistent about this film. I think it's an absolute mess.
Yeah, the Western references are no good. The camera work, which I'll just touch on quickly and we can move on, I do think is disastrous, and not only because of the fight scenes. At least there, it makes some conceptual sense. Did you notice there's a shot early on, and I forget if it's Dalton or someone else at the bar ordering a drink or a coffee or whatever he is, and we get this VR headset swerving from his face down to the drink, up to the person serving it, down to the drink, and mm-hmm. and it's so ridiculous to do that there that it does feel like, you know, some sort of experiment, maybe. It's like, let's mm-hmm. just try this. So I don't think that works at all. I think this is a bad movie, but I clearly think Roadhouse is a bad movie. So I would say these are the two worst movies I've seen this year. I'm not going to go back to 2005 for very similar reasons. I think the absurdity is just not well calibrated here in the way you describe. And obviously we've covered how we disagree. I didn't find there anything sillier here or more winking or more or poorly self-aware in this Roadhouse than in the earlier one. And, you know, I laughed at a few of the stuff that was working on this level. You know, after this first fight, I did like the moment where Dalton is driving his victims, his wounded victims, to the hospital, and they're all in the car together. And okay, that's an okay joke. But then there's a speed bump and he kindly says, bump. And then they all moan when it hits the bump because they're so wounded. I mean, honestly, Adam, I'm not going to defend this movie too much. I think it's terrible. But Gyllenhaal, to me, is giving as much character and playing as much as, you know, someone whose story you understand as much as you need to for what this movie is doing in moments like that. Like you talked about, you know, Swayze's Dalton having this sense of the be nice philosophy. And there's a little something here to what Gyllenhaal is doing, not enough. It's not a great performance by any means, but the gap between these two films for me is very, very thin. I don't know. I don't know what else to say about this. I mean, these were the things that mostly left me wanting, but you think about elements like the crocodile. I mean, that's kind
Do
of
I have to?
Funny, I guess, in an outlandish. How I guess here's what I would ask is like, how is the crocodile scene where I kind of like held my hand up to my cheeks and was like, what is happening in this movie right now? In a way that was like not, I wasn't like really laughing. I was just confused. How is that different than Ben Gazzara's crime boss driving a monster truck through the car dealership of one of the people who's, you know, hasn't delivered their payment to him? I guess this is the calibration thing. Like that was another moment in the original Roadhouse where I was just like, what is happening? Why has a monster truck rally been dropped into this movie? And there's an entire sequence where we're supposed to believe in this world. This is how this mob boss is enforcing his payments, is he's just driving through the dealership.
No, he's not enforcing his payments, Josh. At that point, he's just trying to get Dalton out of town by hurting the people he cares about.
Why is there a monster truck in that movie? Why is there a crocodile in this movie? What's the difference?
Yeah, the answer is the question's irrelevant because it's everything that's happening around scenes like that that really matters and makes up the experience I have with the two films. And if I do not care, and I don't mean care like, oh, they're sympathetic or, you know, man, they're such fascinating, deep, complex characters. If I'm not in any way invested in these characters, I love Red West in the original Roadhouse. I love the Emmett character. I love the Jeff Healey character. I love Wade Garrett. They build those characters. They give us unique elements to who they are, and we get it, and we understand why Dalton then cares about them, which fuels everything. There isn't a single supporting character here who you even know what their name is.
They are
completely irrelevant to this film, and they get nothing. They get no traits. They get no idiosyncrasies, even nothing. They're just, it's all window dressing. And as far as Gyllenhaal goes, I mean, this pains me to say it, Josh, because I've come to be a big fan of him as an actor. And I'm going to blame Lyman Moore for this. I think it's like, he's trying to play. I saw an actor who looks legitimately lost in every scene. Huh. I saw him trying to be a cross between a little bit of Dalton 89 with that Zen thing, but also trying to be the stoic badass that someone like Clint Eastwood is from those Westerns. And then he's also Bruce Banner. He's like the Hulk who's kind of hiding out and don't make him angry because he's always angry. And if he loses it, oh, well, then he turns into this
from the rip the throat thing, right? There's like, oh, he ripped a man's throat. So now we're supposed to just be worried. And then it's the same dynamic going on here.
But I think the first movie does such a much better job of making us understand. And Swayze does a better job of us actually believing that that's something that's haunting him. There's nothing about this character in this film. It's like he shows up on set for every scene with one sense of who his character is and then finds that all of a sudden he's in a different kind of movie. And I think the result is not only just looking lost, it's so bland. All of the charisma, and I do believe there's a ton of it in Swayze's performance in Roadhouse, Josh, is gone here. He underplays things way too much. Like at times he is trying to ape the performances of someone like Clint Eastwood or John Wayne. It's not coherent. It's not a coherent performance in a completely incoherent film.
I mean, it's not a great performance. Maybe I'm not as turned off on it as you. And I think what Gyllenhaal brings is a level of self-awareness that is, I did find that he had the right twinkle, to go back to what I was talking about with Gazzara and Kelly Lynch, and moments like, I forget who it is, but someone refers to his Dalton as Mr. Smiley. And just the way Gyllenhaal responds to that, aware of what his screen presence, his physicality actually is, like, that makes perfect sense that someone would call Jake Gyllenhaal Mr. Smiley in sort of a derisive way. And I feel like he responds to that in a knowing twinkle that works. Is it a great performance? No. It's not a strength of this film. This film has very, very, very few strengths. That's what we can both agree on.
Yeah, I said it a little bit more aggressively than you just did, but yeah, it has very, very few strengths.
You set us up for the
let's go ahead and go with that.
Bottom five worst movies ever reviewed on FilmSpotting. I know we like to stay positive, but I don't know.
It's got to be
maybe
in the top five.
20th anniversary content we've got there.
It's got to be in the top five right now. We'll see if it sticks. And again, I know we disagree about the first one so much that you're going to try to twist this into, I am elevating 89 to some kind of pantheon level status. I'm not, but Josh, I'll say this. The fundamental disagreement we have is that I see the craft on display in the first one and you don't.
Right.
And there's none of it here. And I promise you, as a bonus commentary or something sometime, if it came to trying to explain what I think good filmmaking can be, or what the difference is between good and bad filmmaking, director's choices, using the camera, understanding where to place the camera and how to move it, all you would have to do is pick every scene in Roadhouse 24 that it steals from 89, and there's a bunch, right? A bunch of direct homages. Take every scene that it directly rips off and just show them side by side. I could show them side by side and explain to you why all of those scenes in 89 are still memorable and we still talk about them and sometimes still joke about them. And I'd show the ones in 24 and they would all completely fall flat because they're terrible.
Please do not subject your students to this experiment, sir.
I'm doing it.
You're trying to keep enrollment up.
Roadhouse 24, it's playing exclusively on Prime Video. Josh, while we're on the subject of newish releases that are also remakes / reheat / re whatever you want to call them, reanimations, tell us about Godzilla Times Kong.
Kong can't stop this on his own.
He won't be alone.
It's a lot of fun. I have a soft spot for these. I'm by no means an expert. Similar to you, Adam, before revisiting, I was like, what are they calling these things, these recent Godzilla movies? So I had to be re-educated on the MonsterVerse myself. And that's where I realized that, oh, I've actually seen up to that point two of the four that had been out. And because I have that soft spot, we just reshared our Godzilla versus Kong episode looking at the original films. And I think the original Godzilla is a sci-fi masterpiece. So I'm always curious about these. And I thought, if I've already seen two of these and there's a new one coming out, I'm going to knock out the other two and then see this new one. And I'm glad I did, because although one of the two I had missed, Godzilla, King of the Monsters, is probably my least favorite. It's really the only one of the five that doesn't work. I did like Kong Skull Island and Godzilla versus Kong. It was the most recent one, which I did enjoy. And then I really think the 2014 Godzilla, the one that started this off, is very strong. Godzilla Times Kong, The New Empire, pretty good. pretty good. I would rank it right after that first Godzilla. It's just gloriously nerdy, and it gives us so many things to geek out about if you're at all interested in these movies. Godzilla gets supercharged here, and I don't think this is a spoiler because it's in the posters. King Kong gets a robotic fist, and there are more creatures than you could ever imagine. The basic plot is there's an expedition into Hollow Earth at this point. So they're going deep into the earth, and it's a little bit of a new setting. Here's what I think makes this work is the director is Adam Wingard, who made Godzilla versus Kong. In both movies, you see this eye for giving this fantastic stuff just a dash of charisma and just a dash of wit that carries you through it, that makes it feel less like impersonal CGI. And I'll just give one example. There's a little touch here where Godzilla, after a battle, ends up curling up and taking a nap in Rome's Colosseum and kind of likes that. And so ends up returning to that spot. These are just little touches where it's maybe 2 seconds on the screen, but again, bring some wit to the proceedings. And the other thing, there is the showdown, you know, you're going to get between Kong and Godzilla. Adam, I was so happy. It took place in Egypt.
Daytime
amidst the pyramids, blaring, glaring sun down on these two. And the CGI is very well done. The action is excitingly choreographed. There's another great wit personality moment where Kong grabs Godzilla after knocking him down by the tail and just starts dragging him. And you get like this reaction shot of Godzilla. These become real characters in this movie in the way they are at their best whenever we get these sort of films. So yeah, check it out if you're into the MonsterVerse at all, or even if you liked, you know, the more recent Japanese Godzilla that we got. It's not as good as that. I'll say that right away. There's not the emotional human element that film had, but this one is, for the MonsterVerse, it's up there.
I did joke earlier about not being familiar at all with the MonsterVerse, and while that's true, I have seen one of those films. I think we talked about the Gareth Edwards Godzilla.
That makes sense.
Here on the show.
Yeah.
And gave it a mildly positive review. So it worked for me. I would actually like to catch up with these other films. Godzilla X Kong, Godzilla Times Kong, currently playing in wide release. I wanted to give a quick recommendation to a movie, Josh, that is opening this weekend at the Music Box in Chicago, a film that should be a real treat for the kind of people who tend to go to the Music Box, real cinephiles, real film lovers. It's called Ennio, and it is a documentary about the famed composer, a legendary composer who passed away in 2020. We devoted a show to our top five Ennio Morricone moments. And after watching this documentary, I was so relieved to go back and look at my notes from that top five and find that I didn't say anything embarrassing. That it seemed like a pretty good top five and was halfway intelligent, because I did learn so much from watching this. Mm. My experience watching it was one where the whole time I was thinking, I don't feel like I knew any of this when I did that top five. What did I say? Was that top five 10 minutes long? But of course, when you're breaking down those scenes and you're breaking down some of that iconic music, it's pretty easy to start to get rapturous. And this is a film that was made by longtime friend, longtime collaborator with Morricone, Giuseppe Tornatore, who made Cinema Paradiso, which is one of those all-time Morricone scores and a really wonderful film. This movie is very thorough, maybe thorough to a fault, Josh, a little bit, right? In that this is a composer who made over 500 movie scores, over 500 soundtracks. And in its 2.5 hour plus runtime, we might see or hear all 500 of them. It feels like it is just going at a pace where it's trying to get in every single reference it can. And I don't mean reference, it's trying to get in every moment, a touch of every score, a touch of every bit of music that he composed for that film, as if it is the definitive, comprehensive, you'll only need one Ennio Morricone doc. I've seen some people on Letterboxd comment that in that way, it feels a little bit like a Wikipedia documentary. And it does. I get that. I get that response to it. But especially if you're someone who's only been an admirer of certain films, especially those spaghetti westerns, and you don't feel like you really had any sense of the scope of his career or his influence, then this movie will probably be as educational for you as it was for me. And the big thing about it, Josh, is that it was shot while Morricone was still alive. If it was just that kind of book report where it's talking head after talking head, and it is, it's a lot of them. But if it was just that and not also Morricone, the man and artist, reflecting on his work and reflecting on his love and passion for music and the choices he made, then this movie wouldn't be worth seeing. But because it is all that, it is absolutely worth seeing. I think it's out in limited release now. And like I said, playing at the Music Box, I think seeing this film, even if it itself is not its own incredible artistic achievement, just rewatching those scenes and hearing the music again on the big screen and hearing Morricone talk about what his intent was, that's enough to go to the theater and see it right there.
Well, if listeners do that, they should definitely check out that top five in our archives, because that was a very fun one to do, rewarding for me, educational for me as well. And, you know, we don't get to do music-focused top fives all that often, but I think when we do, it helps us to really think about these movies in a different way. And yeah, Morricone, a great subject for doing that.
Next week here on Film Spotting, Alex Garland's Ex Machina at 10. Yes, we're looking forward to the already divisive, I think. We knew it was going to be divisive before it came out. It was divisive when the trailer came out somehow. And now that people are reacting to its premiere, was it its premiere at South by Southwest? Or certainly showing there. We've seen some of the responses, haven't gone too deep. Want to see the film, make my own judgment call here, Josh. We are fans of Garland's work generally, and especially Ex Machina. So here we are looking back on Ex Machina 10 years later, your number one film of 2014. It was my number one film of the year until I took whatever Conor McGregor's character is taking in Roadhouse 24. I saw Adam McKay's The Big Short, and then I decided that was my number one film of the year. Ex Machina is number two.
I always thought Ex Machina was one of the rare number ones we shared.
I think I kind of thought that too, but according to our producer, who's never wrong.
True.
The Big Short was 2014 and it was my number one.
See, Adam, this just shows you I not only forgive, but I also forget your sins.
Next week, we will revisit Garland's debut film as a director. We'll also return to our William Wyler marathon with 1942's Mrs. Miniver. It won the Best Picture Oscar. It won Wyler his first Best Director Oscar. It's available via VOD or, you know, via interlibrary loan, perhaps. More about the Wyler marathon is at filmspotting.net/marathons. Next week is also Film Spotting Madness Championship Week. The 64 film tourney gets down to two titles. You can vote in the semifinal round now at filmspotting.net/madness. Got a great email this past week from a longtime listener. You'll hear how longtime of a listener she's been in a moment. And she reminded me something that every once in a while, since this past November, occurs to me. I say, I got to mention this on the show, and then somehow never find a way to fit it in. And this email from Jen Wong in the San Francisco Bay Area was the prompt I needed to finally reveal this bit of information, reveal this news, this happy news to the Film Spotting audience. Josh, do you want to take Jen's email?
Hi, Adam and Josh. Hello. I don't write in often, but I have been a faithful listener since the very first episode. Makes me feel so old when I realize that was before my kids were even born. There was about a 2-month span or so in the last 12 months when I didn't have a chance to listen, and I haven't gotten a chance to catch up on those. So did I miss some major Adam life event? I keep hearing references to big life changes, and there are posts showing a 2-year-old baby. I'm going to risk sounding incredibly nosy and ask what happened. Did you have another baby? If so, good luck to you. I'm over 40 and have a 2-year-old and a 17-year-old about to apply for college. Talk about whiplash. If you move states, do not get to hang with Josh anymore. Not sure why these things are burning in my mind, but I guess that happens when you listen to someone talk for hours every week for 2 decades. And if this is none of my business, totally understand, and I'll keep listening regardless. Thanks for the many hours of entertainment.
Thank you, Jen, for the email and for the continued support, for listening. Yeah, we don't necessarily divulge a ton of personal details here on the show, though we also don't hide from them. And we certainly share our personal experiences and opinions as it relates to movies. But one thing I have consistently done over the years is if I've added a new child, I do tell the world that. I do tell the Film Spotting Nation that I've added a new kid. That's pretty life-changing. And, you know, for 10 years, there wasn't any news to share. And listeners who remember our shows from last May will recall that I announced that we had just adopted our daughter, Olivia. So we've had Olivia. We decided, Sarah and I decided to become foster parents, and it doesn't always lead to adoption. It certainly wasn't our plan when we became foster parents, but it did, thankfully, lead to adoption. And this baby girl we got at 7 months old next week is going to turn 4. And as of last May, she's officially or legally part of our family. I alluded to another layer to this back then, but couldn't get into the details then. And that's because we were still foster parents at the time. And we were foster parents to Olivia's brother, who we got actually when he was about 6 days old. We ended up taking him home from the hospital. So we've raised AJ since he was born. And this also, fortunately, led to adoption. So it is true, Jen. You've seen one or two pictures on the Film Spotting Instagram of AJ, the ones at the back of his head as he was watching Toy Story one morning. But AJ is now 2 as of last month. And I do feel bad that I hadn't shared this news earlier because we officially adopted him in November. And I knew someday AJ might go through the archive and he'd be like, well, he talked about Quinn being born. He talked about Connor being born. He talked about adopting Olivia. Holden and Sophie have appeared on the show even, or at least Sophie has, even if it was just in a little outtake at the end or in some bonus content, and she's been part of Trivia Spotting. He left me out. Dad doesn't love me. I knew I had to get AJ in. So we feel very blessed and love having a 2-year-old and an about to be 4-year-old at home. You're not crazy, Jen. I've added another kid.
Very smart of you getting ahead on that childhood trauma, taking care of it in advance. I like that strategy. Yeah, AJ, Olivia, fair to say also at this point, production assistants. I mean, they've been on a handful of Zoom calls on your lap.
Yes, they have.
And they love doing that, saying
they
hi
do.
On the camera.
Yes.
So,
including our weekly film spotting calls.
Exactly.
Our production meetings.
I expect them to be there and add some great ideas, which they usually do. No, I've said before, what you and Sarah have done for both of these kids is it's just incredible, life-changing for them, life-altering, and they're both fortunate and a really, really good spot.
Well, thank you for that, Josh. One other question Jen had in there that we might as well address. She said, if you move states, do you not get to hang with Josh anymore? We probably see each other about the exact same amount, don't we?
So far,
we,
I would
we
say.
Look at each other, yeah. We look at each other every week via computer screen. There's that. I'm just acknowledging we're obviously in contact with each other a lot. But even when we lived in Chicago, I was in the burbs. You were in the city. You did move into the city a few years back. And we would always find time at least a few times a year to have date nights or go to movies or go out to dinner, other concerts and events, sometimes plays with our wives. And we probably get to do that a little less now, but I still come into the city. You've been here. So the short answer is, Jen, yes, we see each other or we hang out a little bit less, but we still get to see each other quite a bit.
And this has prompted, actually, the distance has prompted the first Film Spotting sleepover, I think, in history. Not too long ago, Sam came down as well. We went to a Bulls game and you both crashed here. So
that's right.
That was fun. All right. No babies for me, but a couple of events to give a little notice to listeners about. A couple thanks here. First, I was on the road recently promoting my book, Fear Not, A Christian Appreciation of Horror Movies, and was over at the University of Michigan Dearborn, where I got to talk to listener Phil. So that was great. Also want to thank the prof there, Nick Annarino, who invited me. It was a really good time. And just this weekend, I was in Seattle for Make Believe Seattle. Billy Ray Bruton, longtime listener, puts on this genre film festival, and there was some wild stuff. I got to see my first Larry Fessenden film, Blackout, his new werewolf movie there. I also introduced The Devil's Backbone and talked about that in conjunction with the book. Met a listener, Adam. Kyle came to Seattle from Portland just to see the Devil's Backbone. I know it's not the UK like Andrew, but still, I was impressed by that. Also got to meet James, Eric, and Micah, and even sit in. This was a little bizarre, Adam. Billy Ray, you know, he has his own podcast, Screen Drafts. I think you've been on it, right? Have you been
on? No, haven't. You haven't yet. Been invited. Hope to make it happen.
They had a live recording of Screen Drafts there. So I got to be in the audience this time for the live podcast, and that was a lot of fun. So thank you, Billy Ray, for all that. Coming up, I really hope to see some Film Spotting listeners for this. I usually do every year, but it is Ebert Interruptus at the Conference of World Affairs. This all takes place at the University of Colorado Boulder. It's going to be April 9 to 12, so just around the corner here. We're breaking down over the course of 4 days, Jennifer Kent's The Babadook. More horror. So this is the first you're hearing about it. We watch The Babadook on day one. That'll be Tuesday the 9th in its entirety. And then Wednesday through Friday, we go back from the beginning and break it down. People can interject, ask questions, make comments, and we hope to finish it by Friday. It's free. Come for one day if you can, if you're in the area. Be great if you can come for all the days, but even if you pop in for one of them and you know The Babadook, I guarantee you will enjoy it. And Adam, we always have our annual Film Spotting meetup to celebrate the end of Ebert Interruptus. So that's going to be Friday, April 12th, probably at the usual place, but I'm going to see how many people RSVP first, if we might have to move it to somewhere a little bit bigger. But I'll put that form together. We'll link to it in the show notes. If you're near Boulder, April 9 to 12, and especially if you're there that Friday, the 12th, and just want to be part of the meetup, it would be great to see some folks over there in Colorado.
The Josh Larson World Tour continues. And yes, I do hope many listeners turn out, especially for that Film Spotting meetup. You're buying at least one drink, right?
First drinks on the show. Yeah.
First drink. Yeah. Okay. There you go. This week over on our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show, it's part two of their Crimes of Passion pairing, Rose Glasses, Love Lies Bleeding, and The Wachowskis Bound. Great stuff. Really looking forward to this pair of episodes. That's The Next Picture Show every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is blasphemy. This is madness.
This is absolute madness.
This is madness.
Madness.
Madness, madness.
But this is absolute madness, Ambassador. Why should you build such a thing?
Madness. This is Sparta!
And we close with Film Spotting Madness, our annual bracket-style tourney, best of the 1950s. 64 films, and we are down to just four, which happened to be the top four seeds of the tournament. A lot of chalk, as they say, here in Film Spotting Madness. That final four voting is live. It closes Monday, April 1st. April 1st at noon Central Time. Vote now at filmspotting.net. The polls are right there on the main page, so you cannot miss them, filmspotting.net. First up, Josh, the Elite Eight results. Only four matchups, of course, and really none of them too close. We'll go from biggest blowout to narrowest margin of victory. We start with Hitchcock's Rear Window, the number one overall seed, against Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot.
This comment came in from Trent Robb. I'm a huge Wilder fan, but this is a movie I just don't connect with. Put it in the comedy is kind of subjective category. Now that I think about it, I probably get more laughs out of Rear Window, along with thrills and awe. Rear Window is top four all time for me, so easy choice.
It was an easy choice, it seems, for most listeners. Rear Window, 78%, Some Like It Hot, just 22%, and Hitchcock advances.
Next up, Sidney Lumet's, oh, here it is, 12 Angry Men versus Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen's Singing in the Rain. Jordan Jersick shared this. I'm confused by Josh and Adam's ambivalence towards 12 Angry Men. To be fair, Adam, you're a fan of the movie.
I am a fan.
Yeah, yeah.
I am.
Direct your ire towards me, Jordan. I'm even more confused by their bafflement at its popularity. We're talking about the third highest rated film of all time on Letterboxd. This is one of the most beloved films in the history of the medium. It's also one of my own personal most beloved films. A simple but perfectly crafted story about why we should do the right thing, even when it's hard. It's run manned here, but I hope it wins the whole thing. So Jordan is tapping into something here, Adam. We'll maybe get to this when we see how the bracket competition among us is going. I totally overweighted Letterboxd ranking in my predictions this year.
It happens.
It completely blew up my bracket. I've consulted it in previous years, but for some reason, I use that as one of the main factors to consider. And I saw this too about 12 Angry Men, and just knowing anecdotally how beloved it was, I think I put too much weight on Letterboxd this year.
Yeah, not to belabor it, but I gave, when I last saw it, I gave 12 Angry Men 3.5 stars. So what that means, Josh, is that's very favorable. 3.5 out of 5. I do like the film, I would say even considerably more than you do, but I don't love it. That's the problem. I don't love it on the level that Jordan or many other people do. I definitely don't rate it as one of the probably top 50 films of the 1950s. That doesn't mean I still don't appreciate the film. Aaron Teachman, every madness, there's one movie that sticks around way longer than I think it could or should. And that spot goes to 12 Angry Men in this tournament. It doesn't do it for me. Respect to the stands for carrying it this far. I suspect this will be closer than I want it to be because I absolutely adore Singing in the Rain. Just about the most perfect movie musical ever made. We shall see whether it's enough to make them laugh or not, I guess. No, not really that close, Aaron. Singing in the Rain, 67%, just crushed those very angry 12 men, 33%.
Let's get to the tourney's Cinderella, Night of the Hunter, directed by Charles Laughton, which was going up against Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. Here's David Allen. I picked North by Northwest over Night of the Hunter in my bracket, but am beyond delighted to see Night of the Hunter get this far and may keep voting for it all the way to the end. Not many movies randomly recall images to my mind like this one does. The dead wife's hair floating in the water, the monster lunging at the children on the stairs with his claws out, the predator on horseback in silhouette against the dawn, the woman standing guard with Harry in the background while they sing harmony with each other. Such a shame this wasn't appreciated in its time.
Here's Grant in Lexington, Kentucky. I watched Seven Samurai, my only blind spot among the Elite Eight, so that I could cast my vote for Night of the Hunter, a top 20-ish all-time film for me in good conscience. And Seven Samurai was great, but it's not Night of the Hunter.
Brian also weighed in. Charles Luttenhive, let's go.
Duncan in Royal Oak, Michigan says, probably the two most visually striking movies left in the tournament, and they're up against each other. What a shame this madness is. I went with Seven Samurai, but talk about ambivalence.
Shame. Duncan pulling out the shame on us.
I know. I hope Sam and the rest of the Film Spotting Madness Selection Committee feels sufficiently chastened by that. We'll never know just how hard a choice it was for most voters. We imagine that Duncan wasn't alone. The Luttenhive did kind of show up, not in enough droves, Josh, that they could take down Kurosawa, though. 64% to 36%.
All right, let's get to our final matchup, Billy Wilder's Sunset Boulevard versus Hitchcock's Vertigo. Aaron Teachman weighed in again. I voted for Hitchcock over Wilder on the other side of this bracket, but I'm going to flip and reverse it for this one. Sunset Boulevard is just a better overall package for me. That doesn't leave me with the same bitterness as Vertigo does. Revelatory as Jimmy Stewart, as maybe kind of a bad man, was to me when I first saw it. In the end, both are journeys into darkness, but I think Sunset is more insightful than Vertigo. Fine margins, to be sure, but that's what madness is made of.
Here's Sam Thompson. By far the most difficult matchup this round, both incredible films, but Vertigo offers something mysterious, which brings me back again and again. Sunset is crushing with a phenomenal lead performance. It's hard. Really, really hard. Actually, it is madness, Sam writes. Well done. This one was fairly close. Hitchcock took out Wilder again, though. Vertigo, 55%. Sunset Boulevard, 45%. And I don't know if the selection committee is supposed to do this, but I'm going to give a mea culpa here. I think this is a mistake. Mm. You could say that about madness generally. It's all folly. So
shame.
What mistakes
some
can
might
we
say
really
it's a
make?
Shameful mistake.
Some might. But we do try to be deliberate about certain things. For example, and it worked out nicely. It's not like we had to manipulate the seedings dramatically, but we wanted to make sure that this madness didn't come down to Hitchcock versus Hitchcock. That means if it was going to come down to Hitchcock versus Hitchcock, that had to be in the final four and not in the championship match. Somehow we overlooked that we put Billy Wilder up against Hitchcock twice. That seems a little unfair. I think we could have moved Sunset Boulevard or Some Like It Hot up or down a spot, and it would have ended up in another part of the bracket where it wouldn't have worked out, because we could have foreseen if the seeds played out the way that they probably would, and
right,
they did. We could have foreseen, certainly, that it would come down to Hitchcock versus Wilder twice, and we did wrong by Billy. I'm not saying he would have ended up in the final four anyway. I definitely don't know that, but maybe shouldn't have had two Hitchcock.
Landscape might have been different.
So we are at those final four, two matchups, and here is the Hitchcock double feature, Vertigo versus Rear Window. We also have Seven Samurai versus Singing in the Rain. The top four seeds in the tournament up against each other for 50s madness supremacy. A little lack of suspense, unfortunately, in this final four, in that I haven't looked at how the voting's going in this matchup yet, Josh, but you'll recall that when we did our Vertigo v Rear Window pairing just a few weeks ago or a month ago in anticipation of 50s Madness, we asked our listeners to pick the best Hitchcock. Several hundred film spotting listeners voted in that poll. I think we had, or the best film of the 50s, and we had Vertigo and Rear Window in there, of course. We also included North by Northwest and Strangers on a Train. So yes, that was four films, maybe even other, and that could shake up the vote. But Rear Window won that vote, as I recall, pretty favorably. It would seem like a pretty major shock if in this showdown between these two, it didn't also emerge victorious here.
Yeah. I think the surprise, or not even the surprise, but the curiosity lies in Seven Samurai versus Singing in the Rain, just personally. You know, that's the one, having done that Rear Window versus Vertigo and falling on the side of Rear Window pretty clearly show episode a few weeks back. That's answered for me, but I don't, I'm going to have to give this some more thought. I have an instinct of where to lean, but I need to give it a little more thought before I fully commit and vote.
Oh, so you can't say that you're going to pick Singing in the Rain over Seven Samurai?
That's where I'm leaning. Okay. But I don't want to be rash when it comes down to the final four, Adam.
Okay. Well, I'm waiting for my computer to heat up here a little bit. The hamster wheel has to turn. I will look at the results as they stand this very moment. Of course, this could change. And people don't see how the voting's going. We keep that behind the curtain until the results are revealed. But as of right now, the film that's in the lead, Josh, is leading by 23 votes. So this one is going to be a nail biter. It's going to come down to the deadline Monday at noon. Maybe some of you need to see Seven Samurai for the first time or rewatch one or both of these films.
Get
your homework
idea.
Done. Vote, because your vote really could determine how this shakes out and which two films face each other for 50s Madness Supremacy. Bracket contest. We had over 550 listeners submit their predictions. Last week's leader was Ricky Kendall in the UK. Ricky didn't lose that number one spot.
Congrats,
Madness
Ricky.
Godfather. Mike Merrigan, though, breathing down Ricky's neck.
Oh, no. Here
second.
He comes.
Yeah. Our internal bracket contest is you, me, producer Sam, Madness Godfather Mike Merrigan. He's just in it anyway, but he did also win the tournament last year, and we always let in the previous tournament winner. He is obviously in the lead if he's in second place. I was perfect this round, and that moved me considerably up the ranks. That Seven Samurai Singing in the Rain showdown is going to determine how things go for me here, because right now I went from 113th to 59th. And I'm pretty sure, Josh, that I have never finished in the top 100 bracket challenge.
Does that wash some of the bitter taste of Roadhouse 24 out of your mouth?
Yeah, just a little. You have another reason now to be angry with 12 Angry Men. You had it beating Singing in the Rain, advancing to the final four. You slipped to 245th.
So let me follow up on what I was saying about the letterboxed rankings here. Yes, this was a spiteful prediction because of my distaste.
Cynical.
Let's say cynical. That sounds a little better. And also just knowing how much people love this. So I thought, well, let's put some facts behind this. Mm-hmm. So if you look on Letterboxd, Singing in the Rain, 12,000 fans, average rating, 4.3 stars. Okay. So thinking, well, 12 Angry Men, you know, it's not going to beat that. Pull up 12 Angry Men, 30,000 fans, average rating 4.6 out of 5 stars. And I just, yes, cynical me, but thought, okay, that's more than double the fans for whatever that's worth. But even the fact that people are rating this on average higher than Singing in the Rain, what is going on here? Nothing but nonsense and madness. So I thought, I'm going that way in the bracket. And look what happened, Adam. Look what happened. Me being cynical. Yeah. It came back to bite me.
Yeah. And you made the first mistake, which is applying analytics and rationale to madness. It's madness. Forget about it, Josh.
Oh, don't
it's
talk.
Madness.
Don't tell me you don't have like a multi-layered spreadsheet of ways to predict this.
I had a twinkle in my eye, Josh. I was maybe even winking as I said it, because yes, I've got a spreadsheet breaking down all of this. Okay. Sam was in 89th place, but he picked Sunset Boulevard over Vertigo. Mm. That dropped him to 168th. It would seem that there's a scenario where you don't lose, though, Josh.
That's all I ask for.
It would take Seven Samurai to beat Singing in the Rain. So I suppose now that helps urge you towards your vote, right? Selfishly?
No. I would never do that.
Again, 23 votes is where it stands. I'm not going to tell you which one is in the lead. Turns out our producer, Sam, has never actually lost the bracket contest. He's never had to watch the Adam Sandler Netflix punishment film. So he's due. I'm rooting. I'm not rooting for you in this case to lose. I'm rooting for Sam to lose.
I mean, that makes sense. That seems entirely fair. Sam should lose.
Yeah.
It's high time Sam lost.
In life. Everything's just been too good for him.
Let's not get carried away, but...
Final four voting is open. Vote now at filmspotting.net or find all the information you need about Film Spotting Madness at filmspotting.net/madness. Our Roadhouse show is in the can, Josh.
It's one for the Hall of Fame, I'm sure.
Yes, it is.
If you want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, you can find Adam at Film Spotting and I'm at Larson on Film. Film Spotting Madness Best of the 50s voting is live. It's the final four. Go to filmspotting.net or filmspotting.net/madness. For show t-shirts or other merch, you could go to filmspotting.net/shop. Our show is listener supported. You can join the Film Spotting family over at filmspottingfamily.com. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen early and ad free. You'll get Sam's weekly newsletter, monthly bonus shows, and access to the entire Film Spotting archive.
In that archive, you'll find not only our top five Sergio Leone scores or moments in movies, but you'll find better Jake Gyllenhaal movies. Conversations about those like Zodiac, Nightcrawler, Spider-Man Far From Home, Brokeback Mountain, Source Code, and more. Not in the archive, but should be. I've been meaning to really strongly propose an anniversary look back at some point on a film that stars both Jake Gyllenhaal and Patrick Swayze. That's Donnie Darko. I'm sure we'll get to that eventually. filmspottingfamily.com. Bunch of new movies in limited release, including Femme, which Letterboxd Ella Kemp recommends, Carol Doda, Topless at the Condor, which our friend Mariah E. Gates recommends. Do not expect too much from the end of the world. Our friend Scott Tobias in The Reveal strongly recommends a new Luc Besson film, Dogman, and a new film starring David Krumholtz. All things are coming up Krumholtz these days, ever since his great turn in Oppenheimer. That movie is lousy, Carter. In wide release, you can see a new Liam Neeson movie, small town Irish villager looking to redeem his life after a lifetime of sins. Sounds like a Roadhouse remake. That's called In the Land of Saints and Sinners. And yes, Godzilla times Kong, the new empire recommended earlier by Josh. It will be Mrs. Miniver next week and Alex Garland's Ex Machina at 10.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Hogren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Veronica Phillips. Special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Okay, so is my clock really telling me we did 45 minutes on Roadhouse?
Well, I did have a long intro, but yes.
Okay. All right.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.